Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1, where again we will argue about baseball, soccer, football,
basketball,
other sports. Occasionally, actually, we agree a lot. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And we have at least one interview, maybe bonus interview,
correct,
depending on what happens. But
before we get into the actual topics, we should take a moment and say happy 49th, Lauren.
40 what?
49th.
49th what?
49th original Fox on Show.
Okay.
Show. Fox on Sports Show.
I'm not 49 years old, man.
But it's also a happy birthday week for you, isn't it? Happy birthday.
We try not to publicize that. Nope.
Monday was a big day.
You and
Ichiro.
And Brad Stevens.
Yeah.
Ichiro.
Yeah, and we're going to get to Brad Stevens later. But you and Ichiro and Brad Stevens, this is your week. So
yeah,
happy week.
I don't feel like it was my week. But thank you. It's not often that you can make sloppy joes for your kids on your birthday as dinner. You know, I'll take it. I'll take what I can get. So, every day is my day anyway. I don't need one day a year to feel special. I feel special every day because of the listeners, all
That's right.
five of you. I actually got a nice text from Kevin Rankins about the the segment talking about the three-run bomb.
The players of the week.
The seed.
Last week,
the players
yes.
of the week last week. So, yeah, it's fun to know when people are actually paying attention to things occasionally. And there are nice signs all around town now, too.
For a Rankin's home run?
No. yeah, somebody actually put a mark on the wall that was the BMSL deciding champion home run. No, the signs all over town are for listening to Bedford 105.1, Bedford Safety Radio.
Yes.
So I think
safety and more.
Yeah, I think we need, well, no, there are other bigger ones that say safety radio, but I think we need like Fox on Sports stickers to stick on them.
We should.
Because I don't think it's any kind of trouble if you destroy government property with your own sticker that identifies who you are and then talk about it on the radio.
No, that's just called marketing.
Yes, guerrilla marketing. I'm not doing it. So yeah, those are up. So hopefully more people will listen. It is Friday as we're recording this one. So a lot has been going on. New England is not getting much sleep, although much to my pleasant surprise, I woke up on, what day was that? It was Wednesday night, and it was 11:45, and I had fallen asleep watching the World Series, because this is what I do.
And I'm wondering how this is going to end positively.
The game was over.
But the wrong team won from your perspective.
I know, but I was just shocked.
Okay.
I was shocked that it wasn't like the fourth inning at 11:45. And then I wake up and I go, awesome, this is great. I'll fire up a pot of coffee and watch it till about 3 in the morning.
Yeah, well, it's funny. We saw that a little bit more in the National League Championship
yes.
Series than you would have expected due to all the pitching changes.
Right. Well, you look and you say, why don't kids like baseball? Why don't kids follow Major League Baseball? Well, here's an idea. The games start when my kids are about to get in bed. They yeah. watch 2 innings. Like, what?
Yeah, mine didn't watch any. I wanted them to watch a little bit of at least game one or game two, but didn't quite coincide with the natural biorhythms of a 3 and 4 year old.
No, I was talking to Bedford Little League legend Jeff Vachon when I was in his office the other day, and he's like, yeah, I thought about waking up my daughter for the first pitch. I go, huh? Like, There really is no good way to do it, because on the West Coast, it starts at 5:09. That's a great time.
Right.
Like, you're done at a decent hour. Even if it's the Red Sox and Yankees, the game's still over at a decent hour.
Yeah, 10 o'clock.
I would like to see on weekends. I don't think a weekend needs to be an 8:09 start. A weekend could be a
6:09.
Yeah, there's a reason that they don't play the Super Bowl at 8 o'clock at night. Like, you need to be able to get together, have parties, have pools. Like, this is a community thing. Like, it is. And starting these games so ridiculously late, like, throw me a bone. And even if baseball, you know as well as I do, the games are going to last 3.5 to 4 hours now. Because, and this is a topic that we'll get to in a second, pitchers don't get to work out of jams. We're doing 8 million lineup changes, even though we only have a 25-man roster. Like, everybody bats like it's an all-star game, and or like we're doing the never-ending, the everybody bats continuous lineup. But you look at these games, all right, even if you started a game at 7 o'clock here, and the West Coast, misses the first couple innings or has to bail out of work early.
That's right at home for them anyway.
Right. There are, yeah, exactly. There are 20 million people in California. You only have 60,000 seats or 56,000 seats in Dodger Stadium. I think that the small fraction of people that are going to the game are going to be okay. And I think that given the ticket prices, a small fraction of people that are going to the game are probably the ones who are deciding who gets to leave the office at a decent hour.
Right. Right.
Like, so start the game earlier, baseball. Come on. Like, this is just driving me bonkers.
Right. Well, you talked about some of the pitching changes, and let's get into that. And let's first, of course, mention the two managers here and what an interesting background they have, Joey Cora for the Red Sox and Dave Roberts for the Dodgers. Just amazing that they both have played for both of these teams, and they played together in the major leagues.
Right.
And not to mention they're the first two minority managers to face off in a World Series. But you have some gripes with your head honcho, Dave Roberts.
Well, and I'm going to correct you. I'm sorry. You dropped the wrong Cora in there.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
I didn't say Alex.
Not Alex. Yeah. Which is okay. They're both established baseball guys, so I can understand. Alex Cora is 2 years younger than I am.
Yeah.
When did I get that old? All right.
Monday.
Yeah. Seriously. The other interesting fact, by the way, if you were playing, I don't remember which video game it was, MVP Baseball from 2005, you could set in a lineup, an entire lineup top to bottom of current major league managers.
I don't think I ever played that one. It was Baseball Stars for me.
You'd have, well, that's even earlier, but you'd have Rocco Baldelli now, Gabe Kapler, Jay Bell, Cora, Roberts, AJ Hinch. It's bizarre. So anyway, we're getting to a point where the managers are guys who most of us remember watching play. The biggest really challenge I have is the days of working out of jams are over. And I was going to email Bill James and inquire, but I don't know that he would have any stats for us. What I would really like to know, though, is just the stats of inherited runners, or I guess it would be almost impossible to quantify. The point in time when if you were going to pull a pitcher, you would pull a pitcher, the percentage of runners that score versus when you go to the bullpen, the percentage of runners that are inherited that score. And there's no way to simulate one versus the other because you can't say, well, that would have been the logical time for Roberts to pull.
Well, but that's what you'd have to do. You just have to pick a time, but that would be an interesting study.
But could you have imagined Kevin Brown in game one or game two of the World Series with Dave Roberts going out to the mound with two guys on or the bases loaded?
There'd be a fight on the mound.
Kevin Brown would have Mortal Kombat-ed Dave Roberts' head out of his body and then paraded around and then gotten the third out. And then the Dodgers would have put up a four spot and won the game. Instead, you have these doubly deflating things. And again, I can't quantify this, but a pitcher working out of a jam, you get the, okay, this is our horse. This is our Hall of Famer, Clayton Kershaw. He worked his way out of the jam. He goes in, he pumps his fist, gets out of the inning. He goes into the dugout. Guys are just going off the wall. You put up a couple runs. Yes, we're rocking and rolling. The flip side of that is, okay, the bases are loaded. Or there are two guys on. I'm going to bring in a journeyman relief pitcher by the name of Ryan Madsen, who might as well be wearing a fireproof suit because he's about to light this entire place on fire. So now not only is my Hall of Fame starter now sitting on the bench and has watched his runner score, and he's probably a little bit salty about that, but now I have to deal with the fact that I've just burned Ryan Madsen, and now my team is losing. And on top of that, now we have to go score some runs and everybody's just flat. And you talk about game two, why the Dodgers went down in order for the last 16 batters of the game. They were just emotionally trashed after that fifth inning and their bats went to sleep. That's it.
They did. Well, and they were chilly to begin with. I don't think they really liked the mid-40s temperatures. But let's talk about those two pitching changes in game one, because you're talking about the fifth inning of game one. It's 3-3. Kershaw has thrown 79 pitches. First two men of the inning get on base, and it's 3-3. So
I have momentum, though. Like, I've already chased Sale. Like, I chased their ace. I'm into their bullpen now. Like, jackpot. Okay.
Done. So you're going to stick with Kershaw there?
1,000%.
With the righties coming up?
1,000%. I want that guy to battle.
Martinez.
I want him to battle. I want him to find a way. And to me, Ryan Madsen isn't the way. Like, and this is just, it's been the Dodgers the last couple of years where, like, they will sign guys or trade for guys, and it's like they become the flavor of the month. And it's been little things in these games that are just so ridiculous where a foul ball over on the right side, David Freese takes a weird line on it. The ball, fortunately for the Dodgers, goes foul, but it's not caught. Okay, now Mookie's at bat continues. I think the only positive thing that came out of that, if you're a Dodger fan, is free tacos on November 1st.
And Freeze didn't get injured.
Right. Oh, that would have been fine. Because they would have been forced to play Max Muncy and get away from this whole lefty-lefty, righty-righty thing. Like, Roberts, I love him. I think he's a great manager. I think he's a great baseball guy. He is straight out of central casting. I think he's pretty perfect. But there's this reliance on, there's no reliance on feel. The reliance is completely on the computers and what the computers spit out. And I'm okay with stats as a predictor of future performance. But there also comes a time you have to say, these are the guys who got us there, and we're going to ride those guys. And Roberts or his computer are being outmanaged by Cora, simply because if you had asked Cora what the desired outcome two games in would have been, he would have said, my desired outcome would have been David Freese playing a lot at first base, which he's got five at-bats. Muncy has three. Bellinger's barely seen the field. Jock Peterson, who's been hot, has barely seen the field. And I'm not a Jock Peterson guy. But he's being outmanaged because he is, I'm not even going to say being forced, he is choosing to play lesser righties against these lefties. It's one thing if it's Chris Sale pitching. It's another thing if it's Price. And again, kudos to David Price. Like, he's out of his skull right now. But, like, you have to play to your strengths and not let the other team dictate what your game plan is, and the Dodgers are doing that.
Yeah, I have more of a problem with what Dave Roberts has done with the lefties and righties, and that's something I wanted to ask you is, in Game 2, would you have gone to a more lefty-heavy lineup? I certainly would have, but I want to get back to the pitching changes in Game 1, because personally for Kershaw, I was okay with that move, trying to analyze it objectively from the Dodgers' perspective, because I just thought he looked like he was a little bit gassed. He just didn't quite have it. And I thought it was one of those moves of, you know, we've got two big righties coming up to bat here, Pearson Martinez. Let's go to the bullpen. Let's make sure that Kershaw has all of his energy for his next outing and just expect he's going to come out and dominate that game. And this game is still tied, so let's go to the bullpen and see if we can stop the bleeding right here.
But Christy Mathewson is spinning in his grave at what you just said.
Well, the other
spinning, yeah, like, yeah, high rotation.
Well, that's the day and age we live in. But what about that second big pitching change that the Dodgers made with their stud reliever Baez in the seventh? He'd gotten two outs. And
I can't even say it. Like, I have bad Baez flashbacks, but apparently he's figured something out.
He's figured something out, and big situation in the seventh. It's a one-run game, two on. Devers is coming up, two outs. Would you have gone to the lefty out of the pen there, which brought up Nunez, and Nunez promptly hits a three-run homer?
I have a big problem with, again, taking the ball out of the hot hand, particularly if a guy is throwing well. I have a really big problem with saying, this now is a logical time to make a change for me. If I'm looking at Devers against righties, it's not like Devers is lighting the world on fire against righties. 244 for the year, 18 homers in 114 games. Like,
and Baez already struck out Moreland in that inning.
And Baez is looking like he's perfect, pretty perfect. Like, so I have a hard time with it because it's not like you have a guy who's hitting 380 against righties where there really is a stark difference. If he's a 244 hitter, I still take my chances.
Right.
It's not a big enough difference. It's not like the guy's hitting 360 against righties and 122 against lefties. Like, Devers on the season, 229 against lefties, 244 against righties.
Not that big of a difference.
Big deal.
Yeah.
Big deal. Not worth pulling your guy out of the game.
All right, so let's look at the offensive side of the ball, because game two, you've mentioned David Freese, but he's gotten on base a couple times this series.
He's 3-for-5, yes.
Yeah, my bigger problem is Kike Hernandez, who just keeps striking out at bat after at bat. I mean, I'd really like to see any of those guys you mentioned up there right there, Bellinger, Peterson, Muncy. You know, they put the graphic up during the first two games. Those four guys on the bench, you got over 100 home runs sitting on the bench for the majority of games one and two. I mean, in game two, don't you make a switch there and say, all right, our righties didn't get it done in the first game. You know, we're gonna get these lefties in, not only because they've got a chance to change the game with one swing, but we hope to bring this series back to Fenway Park, and we'd like to get these lefties some at-bats here so they have a clue of what it's like to hit at Fenway Park.
Right. It's strange. Well, as it stands right now, there's not going to be a game six or game seven. I still think this will go six.
And we're taping this on Friday. When you hear this Saturday morning, it might be 3-0 or it might be 2-1.
I don't know. What are you thinking? Where are you thinking this is going to go?
I think the Red Sox have to just feel so good because, you know, they're up 2-0 and, you know, LA's happy to go back and be at home, but the Sox are, you know, they're up 2-0 and they're going to get the nice, comfortable Southern California weather. It's going to be high 80s and they're going to have, you know, all the confidence, nothing to lose. I haven't heard anything about the lineups today, but it sounds like they're going to move Betts to second, get Martinez into the outfield.
It didn't sound like that. I don't know.
Well, they should. But if they do that, they'll have all their bats. And I'd be shocked I wouldn't be shocked if it came back to Fenway, but certainly the Dodgers are not going to win three in a row in L.A. So I would think Red Sox in five or six at this point.
Whoop, here we go. I don't know what this thing's doing now. I was trying to throw a little music in the mix, but, you know.
That sounded like, was that the Osweiler play?
That was the Osweiler play. It was more Joe Buck for all of us, really, because that's what the world needs.
Are we ready to talk some Joe Buck?
Get ready to hear this tonight. I may just leave this playing in the background while we're talking.
That's fine.
I mean, they play it after the Dodgers win, so I'm hoping we'll hear this tonight.
So we may have heard that last night. We may have not.
No, I'll be playing it while
no matter what.
Yeah. It's, yes. It's good flashbacks to the '84 Olympics. Oddly enough, that was like the Nike commercial with Carl Lewis running. You know.
LA Coliseum.
In the LA Coliseum.
Yeah.
Which oddly enough, the Red Sox and the Dodgers played there. What was that, 2008, a preseason game.
Okay.
115,000 people.
Wow, that's cool.
All right. What was the next thing we were going to talk about?
We're going to talk about the travels of Joe Buck.
Oh, my God.
He called game one and two for Fox in the World Series Tuesday and Wednesday night. Then last night, Thursday night, he made a pit stop in Houston to call an NFL game on Fox with Troy Aikman. That was the Dolphins and the Texans. And he was in the booth for the pleasure of trying to dissect a very unique play where the Texans sacked the Dolphins quarterback, Brock Osweiler.
Before we get into that, though, I just want to give my thoughts on Joe Buck.
Oh, please.
I don't like him.
Really?
No. No.
He's good at what he does, though.
I don't think so.
Yes, he is.
I don't think so.
Of course he
is. There's not, like, okay, go back to, for our fans, obviously, you know how I feel about the Kirk Gibson game 188 home run.
I do.
Listen to Jack Buck's call of that.
Oh, so you're a Jack Buck fan?
Absolutely. I can't even, like, the home run call when Ozzie Smith hits the left-handed home run against Tom Niedenfuhr in the old Busch Stadium.
Uh-huh.
When he yells, go crazy, folks, go crazy. Or the Gibson one where he goes, this is going to be a home run. I don't believe what I just saw. I don't believe what I just saw. Like, this emotion. Joe Buck is just, like, forced. I want somebody who sounds like a fan in the booth.
But he's not supposed to be a fan.
But he's supposed to be a fan. We're all fans. People respond to passion.
But he can't.
Like, why do you think when we're talking about, and when we go forward in our DeLorean and we're talking to Michelle Winning about soccer and you're talking about Mackenzie McEachran on the field and why you can't take your eyes off it, because like you root for the people that play hard and try hard.
Yeah.
And so Joe Buck to me is this kind of, well, I'm too cool to be a fan.
Well, like he's a national broadcaster. He's not supposed to be a fan.
So is his dad. His dad was too, but his dad, like there was just, you can show excitement in your voice.
Yeah.
And Joe Buck to me is the kind of the what's wrong with broad, like it's why Tony Romo was a hit in year one. First of all, he was giving good analysis, but second of all, there was a degree of passion and excitement in his voice. And that to me is what Joe Buck is missing.
Okay.
So anyway, Brock Osweiler fumbles.
You might think so. It was a really interesting play because it was a perfect confluence of
fumble.
The old tuck rule, which has been changed. Now, if you try and tuck it in, it's a fumble if it comes out. So that's one thing. And it's the new complementary rule that if your arm is coming forward, then first of all, if the ball comes out, it's an incomplete pass. But the really interesting thing that came into play here on this play, and you got to go watch it if you haven't seen it, is as his arm is coming forward and he gets sacked, his arm starts to go backwards and the ball comes out of his hand and it's like a lateral. And Houston picks it up and goes in for a touchdown, and they call it a fumble on the play and a touchdown for Houston.
Yeah.
They go into review, and you know the end result of this is that they overturn it and they say incomplete pass.
I don't know how you can look at that, and there is such a fine gradation between a fumble and an incomplete pass. I don't know how you look at that and come to a conclusion that anything about that was definitive, other than the fact it was a microcosm of Miami Dolphin quarterback play since Dan Marino left.
That it certainly was. But the funny thing for me was I was listening on the radio. So I heard that play on the radio. And once they said, but the ball went backwards, I thought, okay, well, then it's a lateral. Of course it's a fumble. It was right then that I was getting home. So I go in and I watch the replay. And then wouldn't you know it?
Sorry, I can't talk to you. I must go watch this replay.
Joe Buck was actually right on top of it. And he was describing the rules that come into play. And, you know, what changed it was this: the new rule is that if your arm is going forward, but the defensive player hitting you, if that makes your arm and the ball go backwards, so it's because of the hit, even though your arm is then going backwards, then it's still considered a forward pass because the defense caused you to throw it backwards. And so what they were trying to determine was, is that what happened, or as he was going with his arm forward, did he decide to tuck it back in? So the old tuck rule would have been incomplete pass, but now they're saying if he was trying to tuck it back in and he fumbled it, then it would have been a fumble. So it was the determination of, did the defender make him put his arm back, or did he decide to pull his arm back? And somehow in the review, they thought it was definitive enough to say that it was the defender who caused him to pull his arm back. So they call it an incomplete pass.
It was, I don't know how you can determine intent on something like that.
Right.
We can all say that. I can tell you, honestly, if I was an NFL quarterback and a guy's bearing down on me on a blitz and I've started to throw, I'm going to probably pull the ball in. Like, I'm not going to, particularly if the play is blown up. Okay, I'm bringing that ball in and just hoping that I get out of there with a yard loss and retain the ball. But I'm not going to continue to throw the ball downfield at that point in time. I think the intent piece of that is insanely difficult to rule on. The did you see the DeAndre Hopkins post-game interview?
No.
Oh, my God. Did you see his catch?
Yes.
Okay, so
which one? He had the one on his hamstring?
The catch where the one on his hamstring. He goes up to catch it, and somehow as he's coming down, puts it underneath his leg and still comes up with the ball and ruled a catch. However, offensive pass interference and no more. So DeAndre Hopkins gets into the postgame interview and says, they took my catch away. That was the best catch in the history of the NFL. I think it would be hard to argue that it wasn't among the best catches in the history of the NFL.
Yeah, because he was falling backwards. He caught it with his left hand by itself.
Yes.
And it was just the end of the football. So he was holding it like an ice cream cone. And as he's falling, he as you said, he tucked it against his left hamstring and rolling to the ground, somehow was able to control it. It was phenomenal.
Yeah. And that takes me to the next thing that it's eerily reminiscent of is the throw to third base by Chris Taylor that went through
yes.
Ian Kinsler's legs.
Right.
Yeah. It's just, and as much as all of Red Sox Nation hates Manny Machado, that's not easy to come up with the ball after it has basically matrixed through a guy or nutmegged him.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it from his perspective, but you're right. I mean, he lost vision of the ball for, you know, that critical.
It's within the last 15 feet. Like, your brain can't process the ball changing direction in the last 15 feet.
Yeah, and it's at that time when the runner is starting his slide, you're getting ready to catch it and tag him. So it's at a critical part of needing to be able to see the ball to catch it to make the tag.
Right. So, yeah, craziness there. And you get to a point where you realize that these guys are such insane athletes. The NBA, we'll talk about quickly and then we'll take a quick break. But would you trade 4 first-round draft picks for Jimmy Buckets?
Well, I would try and do the deal for maybe 3 and a player or two. But I've got to tip my cap to Daryl Morey for the mindset of, you know, we're close. We were really close last year. If Chris Paul doesn't get hurt, we very well might have beaten Golden State, gotten to the finals, and won the championship. And he's been all about winning a championship for many years in Houston. They lost Trevor Ariza this year, which was a big loss. They added Carmelo, which...
Where's Ariza now?
He's in Phoenix.
Okay. In his 83rd year in the league?
Yeah.
Yeah.
1 year, I think. That's 15 good. Million.
I played with Bob Cousy, I think.
Yes, he did. Cousy definitely set him up for some three-pointers, they weren't three-pointers back then.
And this is how my... That was a little set shot. This is how my brain works. This is just like one thing to the other. I was at Peter Woodbury yesterday dropping off lunch to my kid as part of a deal that I made with her and saw a kid in a De'Aaron Fox shirt.
Really?
I go, what? Yeah.
In New Hampshire?
In New Hampshire, De'Aaron Fox.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like, what? Are you serious? So anyway.
Well, I like it. He's off to a great start.
He's a good player.
In Sacramento.
Yeah. So I think it's a fun trade. Like, I would love to see him down there, and I think he is the right guy to fit in with Harden and be complimentary and not create a headache that he's not getting enough touches, because he's going to get the right touches that he's going to get his.
Yeah, I think it would be tremendous because they lost Ariza and his defense. Carmelo certainly doesn't replace that defense if he's in the starting lineup. And Butler is known for his great all-around play on both ends. And if you have Chris Paul, Harden, and Jimmy Butler at your 1, 2, and 3, then you can match up against Golden State, who is the other team in the NBA probably with that could match that 1, 2, and 3 with Curry, Thompson, and Durant. I mean, those would be the best 1, 2, 3s in the NBA.
These teams are just sick. And now they're putting up billboards in New York City trying to get Durant to come to the Knicks. Even though they're not the prettiest billboards, I like the idea. It's fun. This is what makes the NBA fun, is this whole, like, people talked about super teams being bad for the NBA. I think this is all right.
Yeah, there's a couple narratives that the media dissect throughout the year in the NBA. The first one is the player movement. And when you've got impending free agents with the likes of Kyrie and Durant, both of whom have been rumored to be interested in New York, that is going to be a storyline all year long for both of those guys. Kyrie kind of got ahead of it before the season started by saying he intends to re-sign with Boston, which is huge for the Celtics. But, you know, I don't think there's been any sort of indication from Durant on any clarity. So certainly all those cities and teams are going to be clamoring for his services if he's going to consider walking out of Golden State. The other one is the MVP race. You know, NBA media loves to talk about that. 365.
Yeah.
And so Giannis Antetokounmpo is the front runner there. He's off to an amazing start with Milwaukee, and it's kind of fun to have that discussion and, you know, think about who the best player in the game is.
He's What's he averaging, 29 and 16?
Well, yeah.
He's filthy.
The stat was he's the first player since Wilt Chamberlain to have 25 points and 15 rebounds in each of his first four games to start a season.
Boy, yeah. He's fun. The NBA, if you haven't watched it in a while, is well worth watching. So I know both of us watch it, but and some watch it up here, but it doesn't seem nearly as much as should. But maybe that's what happens when baseball's done.
Well, maybe some of our listeners caught some of the Celtics game last night since it was a non-World Series night, and it was a TNT game against Oklahoma City and the Thunder, and really fascinating final minute of play that I wanted to get into. We've talked about Brad Stevens on this program quite a bit, and of course, he shares a birthday with you, so we've got to talk about him today.
Yes.
But I was enthralled with what he did last night. It was really, really fun to see. Tie game on the road. Celtics have, first of all, the Celtics were down by, I think, 16 points at half. And at the end of the third quarter, they're up by one because they put up like 40 in the third quarter and hit eight or nine threes. Anyway, of course, they never quit. But here we are in the final minute. It's tied. Celtics have the ball. Kyrie Irving is sort of dribbling about 5 feet behind the three-point line near the Celtics bench. And there are, what did I say? There's 35 seconds left. So what does Brad Stevens do? He starts sprinting towards the referee, calling for a timeout. And there aren't many coaches in the NBA who would do that. There are some, I think, who would call the timeout. But for him to be, he noticed right away that there wasn't anything happening with a play. Kyrie was just dribbling. Nothing was happening. And he had the clock in the back of his mind. Why did he do that? He sprinted to the referee to get that timeout called right away to go 2-for-1. He wanted to call timeout, set up a play, get a quick shot off, and then, of course, the 24-second shot clock, he was going to get another possession no matter what Oklahoma City went down and did on their possession. Sure enough, they come out of timeout, couple quick passes. Our buddy Marcus Morris hits a three with 28 seconds to go, and the Celtics were locked into getting another possession as long as they, you know, if Oklahoma City scored or if they got the defensive rebound. And, you know, it worked out perfectly. Oklahoma City comes down and misses. Celtics hit some free throws, and they lock up another victory. And you might not have ever noticed it, but if Marcus Morris misses that three, Oklahoma City comes down with their possession. The Celtics are still going to get another possession to either have a chance to tie or have a chance to win.
Right. It's funny, too, because when coaches are in the moment, it's difficult. And when anybody's in the moment, we all kind of make it seem like we're armchair quarterbacking, that it's easy to make those decisions on the fly, but there are 1,000 things that are going on that he's paying attention to. He's got to be completely locked in on the clock and doing the right thing there. And you hope at that point, too, that he's had a conversation with Kyrie after the fact and said, hey, this is why I did that. So now you have a coach on the floor, so he doesn't have to go about doing that. And Kyrie's been around long enough, smart enough to know that and to apply it the next time. And that's really all you can ask out of your players anyway. So we will we'll take a quick break. Come right back with Michelle Winning, the coach of the girls soccer team at Bedford High School. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Back here on Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1, Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and we are joined by Bedford High girls soccer coach Michelle Winning, fresh off a 4-0 win over Bishop Gerton last night. Coach, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Coach, great win yesterday. I had the pleasure of calling the game on BC TV 23 with Harry Kozlowski, and we thought that McKenzie's first goal to get you on the scoreboard 1-0 in the first half was really big. And you know, how important was that from your vantage point to get that first goal and then have your defense take over?
Yeah, I mean, it was nice to have that goal up there, but to be honest, I didn't feel like it changed the game for the first 20. That part of the game was just kind of see who could weather the storm of physicality, and it didn't really faze us that we had a goal up there because it was just such a physical part of the game. Once the game started to settle in a little bit, then it gave us a little bit of confidence to just kind of get our rhythm and go into the second half a little bit more settled.
Yeah, we thought you matched their physicality and did start to settle it in, and it was 1-0 at half, and of course it finished off 4-0, and McKenzie had two goals and two assists with some really outstanding all-around play. What was your favorite play that she had yesterday?
I liked her first goal a lot just because she kind of got to something that nobody thought she'd get to, and that's her style of play. You know, you always think it's going to go out of bounds, and then she just comes out of nowhere and we'll save it. And she kind of came out of nowhere on that one, you know, and just got a touch past the keeper, and I don't even think the keeper expected it. But, like, more than that, with McKenzie, I just love watching every single play with her because she's excited. She celebrates every goal like she's never scored before. She just has a passion for the game that's evident in every play she makes.
Well, just as a more casual fan and less experienced soccer player, you watch somebody like that play, and it becomes pretty immediately obvious who the game is going to kind of go around, simply yeah. because just that speed is such a difference maker for her.
It is, and when she gets going to goal, she's dangerous, you know, and then she's smart enough to dish it off, and it's just an energy out there that you don't see in many players, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like you described, that goal, she used her speed to have that surprise one-timer, and it got past the goalie before she really even knew what was coming, and then she really had a great celebration after that first goal, you're right.
Yeah, she always jumps into somebody's arms, and it makes it special for the girl. You know, it makes every goal mean something, so it's really just fun to watch her play.
Yeah,
well, and for our listeners, too, who might not have seen them play, she's a peanut.
Yeah, she is.
But she plays a lot bigger than that.
Oh, God,
I mean,
yeah.
You talk about, you know, every time she touches it. I really enjoyed every time she touched it because she just showed off great poise and skill. You know, she would always catch it with somebody marking her, but then she would just calmly make her move, whether that's she would dribble and beat at least one or two defenders, or she would turn and make a pass that would lead to a positive opportunity.
Yeah, she has a way of getting between people. It's pretty creative sometimes. Yeah, she's fun to watch.
Well, her second goal had a way of getting between one of the defenders and the goalie. It was a really unique goal where she scored it directly off of a corner kick. So how much credit can you take for that particular goal? And, you know, when's the last time one of your players scored directly off of a corner kick?
Yeah, that I don't think anybody even knew that goal went in, actually. It just kind of took a turn that we'd never see. The wind kind of dropped it and pushed it into the net. I don't take credit for that at all because we never really go into a corner kick to try to score on them. It just kind of happens. Those things happen. We don't score on corners very often. I think we scored on two yesterday, so that was kind of nice to see. But to answer the last time one of our players, it wasn't a corner kick, but I think it's worth sharing. Gabby Forte, she does the flip throw.
Yep.
She scored off of a throw-in that was deep in the corner, like right at the goal line. And it went far post upper 90. So that was kind of shocking.
Does anybody have video of that kicking around?
I don't know if they do. And the keeper, like, had she known better, she would have just let it go because it only counts if somebody touches it before it goes in. But the keeper actually tipped it in. But I don't know that they have video. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, we might have to see if we can dig that up. If any of our listeners are listening and know, I ask for a selfish reason. My 9-year-old has mastered the throw-in, but she's a gymnast and is working on the flip throw.
Oh, yeah.
It's
definitely dangerous.
But
to get back to corner kicks, they're tough to defend, but you don't see a ton of goals off them, actually, I don't think.
No, you don't. I mean, we were trying to give you some credit on that. You didn't have to give it to the wind.
I don't know. I don't take credit on anything these girls do. I mean, I just put the pieces together, and they get out there and play the game. You know, try to keep their heads straight and keep them together as a team, and what they do out there, that's all them.
That's a mark of a good coach. We're here with Bedford High girls soccer coach Michelle Winning. Yesterday, the defense was strong throughout the game. Tell us how they're able to click so well together.
Well, three of them, Gabby, Jess, and Bree Coco, they're best friends off the field as well. They're all seniors, and they've played together for a while. They have really high expectations for each other, and they legitimately care to help each other as teammates and friends. So right there, with three out of the four being so close in so many aspects of their life, like if one person makes a mistake, they're there to back it up. They can say things to each other, and it gets left on the field, you know. And Bree back there really leads them, and Jess and Gabby have really come around to form around that leadership. So those three have clicked right from the beginning. That fourth link took us a long time to find someone who was going to fit into that intensity and not get rattled by those three players with those high expectations. And just recently, Anna kind of stepped up into that role. So, and she fits in very nicely with her composure. She doesn't get rattled by things, and she's playing well. She steps at the right time. So, yeah, I'm happy with the back four, but like I said, it took a while to get to that point this year.
And you alluded to it, the leadership that's back there, but you also have some inexperienced players because this is high school and kids graduate. It's not like you sign them to a six-year free agent deal. They stick around forever. How have the vets helped the rookies round into form?
Yeah, that's been our biggest challenge this year, to be honest. The personalities of the veterans are a bit more intense than the rookies coming in, so there's been a bit of a division. It's taken a long time for them to kind of mesh together and to work as well as they are right now. I've actually made some personnel changes to go with a bit more experience. So right now we're starting 5 seniors, 6 juniors, and we only have 1 sophomore, but she played every game last year. So, yeah, that's kind of a good question because I don't feel like that's our strength. I feel like the leadership has been there. The camaraderie has been there, the attempt, but it has taken a lot of effort on the juniors and seniors to really bring this team to where we're at right now. That's our biggest challenge all year.
So as we head into the quarters on Sunday night, you get Concord. How do you prep the team? You're coming back. It's Friday. You played Thursday. It's what if you're talking about a starting pitcher, you're coming back on short rest. How do you prep for the next round?
Today's going to be light because I'm pretty sure we're banged up from that first 20 minutes up there.
Yep.
I went to see Concord play last week. I have a solid game plan, and it's really getting those heads back straight. Everything tactically in terms of our game plan and our attack is pretty much sound and going forward. They know what to do at this point. You know, you just practice the little things, get the nerves set, get the heads in the right places, and talk a lot about just kind of where their mindset is at and when they're going to peak and, just tweak the little things around what I saw last week. They'll be ready to go.
Look, like another thing you did towards the end of the second half there was you got a bunch of substitutes in for a good 10 to 12 minutes. You got them some experience. You got your starters some rest. But what would you say about the mindset of the team? Because to me, it looked like a really strong overall performance. Are you feeling really good about the team as it's coming together heading into the quarterfinals?
Yeah, I feel good about where we're at. I mean, Concord's a tough opponent, probably the toughest draw that we could get for the quarterfinal with Grace Devaney there. But I think we're ready. I think mentally this team is in a really good place. I think we have the experience, and so many girls have played in such big games that sometimes I walk into practice and they're kind of squashing some of the chatter before I even get to it. So the experience of the upper girls is really obvious to me as a coach, which is great. And I think that's going to give us a bit of an edge over Concord on Sunday. I think these girls have played in big games and they know what it means to be there and they have passion for it and they're going to make it happen.
It's going to be a lot of fun to see what that next step or steps are, even though we're not going to talk about anything past this step. For you as a mom, as well as a coach, you have young kids that play sports and you yourself were a multi-sport athlete. What kind of direction do you give your children about playing sports, if any?
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's all different than when we played. You know, it's just multi-sport athletes, it's tougher for them now. It's, kids really have to specialize and pick what they want to do, unfortunately. We're fortunate that they love to ski, so they're ski racers, and that's a passion of theirs. But when it comes time to on-field sports and stuff like that, we don't really guide them. We just kind of say, hey, do what you want to do. We'll support you in whatever, create opportunities for you. And, they're kind of going down that direction of soccer, but I think a lot of it has to do with being around my team. I think they come to every home game. They love watching the girls. They're connected with them. And they say they want to be Bulldogs someday. And although I don't put pressure on them for that, it's just kind of engraved in who they are. So we'll see what they end up doing. Who knows? They may be athletes. They may not be. But whatever makes them happy is where we kind of guide them.
It's a good approach. It's always a challenging thing when you're a parent to you get caught up in what's going on with everybody else. But then you have to realize the most important thing is that these kids are happy and are enjoying whatever they're participating in, even if they're playing around in the dirt in the backyard. Hey, if you're having fun, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and the last thing I want to do is put pressure on them just because I love soccer. They don't have to. They just their kids. Let them do what they want to do. And as long as they're putting effort in and respecting their coaches, I don't care what they're doing.
It's awesome. You hit on the respecting the coaches too part, which that's pretty critical as well. Well, Coach Winning, we appreciate the time. Best of luck on Sunday. And hopefully we'll be there cheering you guys on as well.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for taking us and supporting us.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Good luck, Coach.
Thank you for the time.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
That was Coach Michelle Winning, the coach of the Bedford High girls soccer team. We'll take a quick break. Come right back. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and we are joined by Bedford High Athletic Director Corey Parker. Corey, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, guys. Good to be back.
Of course. Nice break in your in what is always a crazy time for you. Anytime there's sporting events going on, but we're coming to the conclusion of the fall sports season. What are some of the storylines that you've seen that a casual fan who's more looking at scores might not be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they're not concluding too soon. Hopefully we've got a couple more weeks and all.
Exactly,
that.
Yes.
Certainly a lot of people in town, whether their kids are on a specific team or not, you know, may not be seeing the big picture of what's going on here with a lot of our teams. But it's been an exciting fall. You know, a lot of teams have had the adversity roller coaster of injuries and kids bouncing back and, you know, the adversity that comes into play with all varsity-level teams. So it's been a fun process to watch, and I think what's really exciting right now is, for the most part, a lot of our teams are in really healthy states. And so from a varsity head coach standpoint, you know, they feel good about going into the tournament when they can be healthy and all the players are available and, you know, hopefully peaking and tapering at the right time. I think it's been exciting to the fact that we've strived to host as many playoff games as possible, which on record wise puts us that we're, you know, to the top of the brackets. And fortunately we're there right now with football in a situation to host throughout to the finals. Boys soccer, girls soccer both hit the max as far as home playoff games. And so I know the captains and the coaches, that's always an internal goal for them as a team to get to that point. But it's been exciting. I mean, I would say a unique year from a fall sport perspective, and this being my eighth year here back in New Hampshire, we went from excessive heat and cancellation of practices because it was so warm in August to excessive rain and teams being in the gymnasium when they shouldn't be and canceling of practices. And, you know, so it's been a unique fall and adverse in that regard, is, you know, postponements and reschedules and makeups and back-to-backs, some things that on paper, when we do our schedule 6 months out, we don't hope for. But I'll give credit to the kids. They've all dealt with it, accepted it, moved on, and just doing the best they can to put their best foot forward. So nothing specific, like I said, about our teams, just an exciting fall as always with a lot of fan support for playoffs and teams advancing. So the more we see Bedford and the Union Leader at this time of year, the better.
Right.
In the sports section, because it's outlining that we're advancing in the playoffs.
It has been good so far. Football is the one that everybody seems to always be talking about. Coach Stank is a great storyline. He's a new dad. Great, successful season. You're a dad. How's he balancing all this?
He's not. Speaking for dads, he's not. He has a wife in Sarah Stank who is exceptional. And much like every, I think, father would attest, the mothers are the key cog in making sure the family life is still going and fed and sleeping and changed. And as great as Derek is, and I know he's maximizing his home time, he'll be the first to admit Sarah is the rock behind that and keeping things going. And, you know, being a high school coach, especially at the varsity level, especially of a program with the magnitude of a football team, it takes exceptional organization, structure, vision, and time. And you can be really good at it and struggle with a family component. And I'll give Derek a ton of credit for balancing the two and maximizing that to the best of his ability. But Sarah Stank, who will be, you know, in the stands this evening, probably bundled up, I would assume, if little Deck is here. And, you know, she's the cog that keeps that going, no question.
Well, Corey, another Bedford varsity coach who is apparent is Coach Winning. And, of course, you were there yesterday when Bedford beat BG 4-0 in girls soccer, and we had a chance to speak with Coach Winning earlier in the program today. What are some of your takeaways for the girls soccer season so far?
Yeah, it's been an exciting one. Another team that's dealt with girls getting 10 victories a year and not been able to, you know, be at the level and on day-to-day basis with a full 18-girl strong team. I think they're coming into stride now. It's great to see four times that ball hit the back of the net last night. I think that helps bolster their confidence going into a big 4-5 matchup Sunday night here at the stadium at 7 p.m. And, you know, I think the confidence is starting to really strengthen for the team right now by results, certainly. And coming back and beating BG after falling to them 1-0 on homecoming weekend, I think says a lot about the team's focus right now. And certainly you got to attribute a lot of that to Coach Winning and Coach Pisano and just kind of keeping the girls in the right mind frame at this time of the year. It's, you know, my shoes, obviously I speak to coaches on a daily basis and the students every day. And the grind of the season is something that's underrated. And I think Coach Winning's got a great sound approach to keeping that in perspective and finding days to keep it light, keep it loose, keep it very, you know, minimal as far as pushing the bodies and making sure and appreciating the recovery process. And, you know, I think in the last week here, it's kind of paid dividends, and hopefully it can for three more games.
She had indicated something similar to us as well, just that they were going to be a little bit banged up after the physical game. So, yeah, it doesn't make sense to keep your foot on the gas pedal at that point. Here with Corey Parker, the Bedford High Athletic Director. And in addition to the soccer going on Sunday night at the high school, we have three field hockey games out there. The NHIAA Division 1, 2, and 3 championships will all be out there. What goes into hosting an event like that for you and for your staff?
Yeah, I mean, it starts with just the commitment of this town on building a first-class facility and one that we're lucky enough to showcase and host, you know, the top six elite field hockey programs each and every year and bring teams down from Hanover and Newfound and Prospect Mountain and programs to want to come here and play and be able to host. That's a great honor. You know, it's something that we're striving to hopefully get into, and so that the advantage of hosting the state championship with the possibility of our team being in it is a great opportunity, no less. But just to showcase Bedford and our platform is something that, you know, I'm privileged to kind of run, being the high school athletic director, and I hope it's something that the town doesn't take lightly because it's a great honor. From a game perspective, obviously, it's pretty much everything you see if you come to the game. So from an organization structure standpoint, we'll work closely with the NHIAA as far as getting the programs, getting the communication for our press box, for our announcers. But as far as the game goes, we operate and run it similar to a home football game this evening as far as the ticket takers, the gates, the concessions, the workers, and lining that up and confirming with all the officials and just trying to do our best to make the environment as comfortable as possible for the officials so that they know what they're getting into and communicating throughout today and tomorrow, or excuse me, yesterday and today with the qualifying teams and making sure that they, you know, feel like they know what they're walking into when they get here. And then from a fan perspective, making sure that the place is as clean as can be and well-lit, well-secured, and well-available for parking and hopefully make the experience for those 2 hours for everyone that comes a good time.
Awesome. Well, hopefully we'll have the opportunity to get down there and catch some of that. But you mentioned the weather getting cold. Winter sports are right around the corner. I can't even believe it. But what do parents and students need to know to ensure their student-athletes don't miss out?
Yeah, twofold. One, most importantly, is November 2nd is the conclusion of the first quarter. And that first quarter academic success dictates the athletic involvement for the winter season. And although we monitor it pretty closely, it's important for parents to know that, to remind their sons and daughters of that, so that if they're facing any academic struggles and they may not be passing four of their current classes, they need to come see me immediately if they haven't yet. And certainly their counselor is a good starting point with that as well. because we are student first. After that, there is an online sign-up Google form. That is the first step to being a student athlete. It's on our athletic webpage, and it just says preseason sign-up form. Right now, we've got about 340 kids that are signed up, so our average is about 415 to 420 typically. So we're, you know, about two-thirds of the way there, so I'm hopeful this weekend we're going to get a lot more sign-ups there. That's a crucial step in the process, because once they sign up, we start to outline our database specific to each team. And prior to that, let's just say Sue Thomas, our girls basketball coach, although I'm sure Sue knows every girl coming out, she doesn't have our incoming freshmen's emails because we don't blast out every individual sport information to the whole school. And so that preseason form is vital in the process of getting the communication. But after that, next Thursday, the 1st, we have our quick coach informal sign-ups with the kids. And at this meeting, we just verify who needs concussion impact testing, who's all set with their physical, and just kind of cross all our T's with paperwork. Following week, where we have our impact testing and concussion testing for all our student athletes, every day each sport's assigned a specific day to do so if they need that test. And then November 12th is here pretty much. And November 12th starts for swimming and wrestling, followed by the 26th for hockey and girls basketball and track. And then December 3rd for the ski programs as well as our boys basketball program. And so we get rolling. We get rolling quick. Obviously, I think our numbers are going to be a good place. I think we'll have tryouts on a lot of the teams, not necessarily just team selection, which is a great problem, I guess, for our coaches, because it dictates that our program's in a healthy state as far as kids wanting to compete and wanting to be on our teams. And so that's a good thing, although tryouts are never easy that third day for coaches. And having those conversations as a program, that's a good thing that we're getting the interest there for kids that want to wear a Bulldog jersey.
Certainly is. So speaking of wearing the jersey, no, you're a huge Red Sox fan. Have you been staying up late watching games one and game two?
Absolutely. I mean, how can you not? No, I mean, that started a couple of series ago, obviously, and then the 4.5-hour Houston games certainly started to beat me up. But
yep.
Nonetheless, no, it's interesting. I jokingly had a conversation with my trainer last night saying, I'm not sure when I'm going to go to bed because the norm has been, you know, quarter one or one-ish, which is productive, I will say. Watching a baseball game, you can keep the laptop out and be somewhat productive. And so I know I've been sending more emails than usual at midnight the past week and a half, but at the same time, it's helping the communication a little bit. But no, it's great. Playoff baseball, in my opinion, is right up there with many sports in the playoff atmosphere. Just the coach strategy, the difference and appreciation of the one-game mentality versus 162 games over regular season, it's just a completely different fan experience. And so if you're a fan of baseball and seeing Porcello come out of the pen or seeing the pitching changes every other batter and just, you know, watching starters become seventh inning, you know, relief men, it's, I think as a baseball fan, it's a great thing to appreciate and watch. And certainly as a Red Sox fan, you know, Alex Cora's pushed all the right buttons at this point, and kudos to the players, obviously, be living up to it. And I would say the Houston series, I think, has been more fan excitement than L.A. No disrespect to you, Lauren.
It
definitely has a different feel to it. But maybe games in L.A. over the next couple of days will change that vibe. And if the series comes back to Fenway, I think that'd be good just for overall baseball, certainly for the economic side of Boston. I don't think that'd be a bad thing to see at least a game six. But hopefully they can close it out and they can celebrate another championship.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. Houston, I think, was somebody that everybody was sort of gunning for. I think it also helped, though, for whatever reason, Red Sox fans always love a villain.
Sure.
And Machado fits into that, but he's even kind of dialed it back a little bit, game one and game two. Bregman really fit into that mold perfectly.
Yeah, I would agree. He definitely did play the role, and you're right. I think fanhood love villains and love someone to root against rather than rooting for, which is just kind of society a little bit. But the I agree with you. And like I said, I think Houston was a big struggle. I wouldn't say this is anything like 04 when they got through the Yankees and they knew it was over in four or five games in St. Louis. But it certainly doesn't. It does have a different feel, I would say that. But that definitely will keep me in front of the TV at least.
Right.
After varsity football tonight, I may catch the last three innings. So I'll enjoy those three innings on my couch in a climate-controlled environment, because I'm sure it's going to be pretty chilly this evening.
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit cold. Well, as always, we appreciate the time. Hopefully we'll see you at one or more sports this weekend. And as always, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it, guys. Have a great day. Thanks so much.
Take care.
That was Corey Parker, the Bedford High Athletic Director, waxing poetic on a variety of different things. But did we have anything else that we were going to go over on this, on the remaining few seconds that we have of this show before we go too far over?
I think we may have covered it.
We covered all the high school stuff, or a large part of the high school stuff, really. Oh, the only other thing I had, BMSL sign or BMBL signups.
That's right.
If you're signing up for basketball,
do it today.
Do it today, Saturday.
Saturday.
Or yesterday, Friday. That's weird.
Do it today, Saturday.
Do it. Do it now.
Draft is tomorrow, Sunday.
BMBL.net. They will be drafting. It will be televised on BCTV. And there will be sure to be lots of excitement and intrigue. I believe Mel Kiper Jr. will be there.
Interviews.
Yep,
Lauren,
exactly.
You'll be there. You'll be on the mic.
I will not.
You'll be on the mic.
I will not.
And you'll be getting drafted. It'll
yeah,
be
no.
fascinating.
Exactly, yes.
You'll be interviewing yourself. How did it feel to
self? Note to self. So with that said, yeah, go to BMBL.net and register for the Men's Basketball League. Otherwise, Damon Avella will text you and ask why you haven't registered yet. I still haven't registered yet.
Still time.
I still have broken things. Anyway, I need to heal them. So thank you to our guests, Michelle Winning and Corey Parker, for coming on short notice, as well as the crew here at Bedford 105.1, Harry, Chris, Bill, and Colleen, who stopped by the window and waved at us after we forgot to let her know that we were using the studio today. Sorry. And enjoy a great sports week, and hopefully we come back with a bunch of victorious Bedford teams going into next week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.